It's the Motorsport Show here on Love Sport Radio. You're with me, Johnny Burrow, and Lawrence Barreto, senior writer for F1.com. Lawrence, Silverstone is an institution of British racing, and it didn't disappoint for the British Grand Prix at the weekend.
No, I think after Austria, we were wondering, could we get a race as good as that? And yes, we did. I'm delighted to say that we've had two races on the bounce that have delivered absolute crackers. Silverstone traditionally is a circuit that fosters good overtaking, fosters good racing, has dodgy weather, so that normally mixes things up. And we didn't get any of that this weekend, but we didn't need it because it was one hell of a race from Lewis and Valtteri battling for the lead to Charles and Max battling for second and third. And you know what? I think we're going to get into this a little bit later, but I think they're real stars of the future.
And with that Hamilton and Bottas duel, obviously very exciting. Does it slightly detract from that excitement when they're on the same team?
No, I don't think so. I think what was really good about this race was that for once, Bottas fought back. So in many times we've seen that, you know, Bottas has won races. He's taken pole positions for Mercedes. But what we haven't actually seen is Bottas being able to show that he's able to pass Lewis Hamilton, which I know might sound like a stupid thing to say, but we really just genuinely haven't seen it. And then at Silverstone, we had Bottas in the lead. He kept the lead to start with, so that was pretty impressive. And then he managed to hold off what looked like a much faster Lewis Hamilton. Lewis managed to get ahead. He pulled across. And then Bottas thought, well, I'm not going to let this happen. And he had another stab down the inside and got him into Cop's corner, one of the fastest corners on the circuit. And Lewis said after the race that, you know, he's my teammate and I didn't push him perhaps, or I didn't defend as much as I would have done. And, you know, that's fair enough. But at the end of the day, you can't take away from the fact that Bottas still had a go. He still went for the lead. And he just showed, I think, I know he ultimately lost the race, but he showed in that race, particularly for me, that he's a genuine contender for Lewis. And I don't think we've seen that at the whole time that they've been teammates. And I think that's really exciting, I think, for Formula One.
He put the pressure on Hamilton, of course. With that in mind, how impressive a drive was this from the Englishman?
It was brilliant. Like, there's just something about Silverstone that he loves Lewis, and Lewis seems to love Silverstone. And even when he got beaten to pole by Bottas, and even when he didn't manage to take the lead at the start, which is generally the best time to get the lead, you still felt that he had a chance, and he was pushing. He was putting a lot of pressure on him over the first stint. Then Bottas pitted, as he ordinarily would have done, and Lewis would have done this a few seconds later, or a few laps later, rather. Then the safety car came out, and normally a safety car makes a race more exciting because it mixes things up, it puts people off. But what actually it did was give Lewis a free pit stop, and that moved him ahead of Bottas. Because he, so the time that it
is
was,
that not just straightforwardly unfair?
I mean, it's unfair, it is, but that's just the way it goes. Like, it could have worked the other way, and Bottas could have benefited from it. It's a shame that it kind of tapered what was turning into a really exciting battle. Obviously, they didn't throw the safety car out for the hell of it. There was a car in the gravel, and it was for safety reasons that they threw the safety car out so the marshals could go on track and remove, I think it was the Alfa Romeo of Antonio Giovinazzi. But the fact is that this is just, you know, no one planned for it. This is just what happened, and Lewis made the best of it.
Yeah, well, you've got to capitalise when you can. Talking of a need for a safety car, what is going on with Vettel? Because he crashed again.
You know what? He's probably asking himself that very thing because I don't know what's going on with him. You have to go back. If you go back to the German Grand Prix last year when he made that mistake when he was leading the race and should have really won on home soil, he's made mistake after mistake after mistake. I think he's made 7 mistakes in races since that time, which frankly, for a 4-time world champion and someone who's supposed to be a title contender and the lead driver at Ferrari, it's just not good enough. The mistake that he made at Silverstone was the kind of thing I guess you'd see if you go go-karting with your mates, which I know is not great when we're talking about elite sports people, but it was elementary. It was disappointing to see that kind of thing from a guy of his stature. And to be fair to him, after the race he went over to Max in Parc Fermé and he shook his hands and kind of apologised for what happened. And when he spoke to the media, he admitted it was his mistake. And he did all the things that he should have done. But the fact of the matter is, he shouldn't have made the mistake in the first place. The safety car actually worked in his favour. So he was around 4th or 5th at the time. he was promoted to third on the track, and the Ferrari was actually pretty strong. If you look at the pace of Charles Leclerc, it was a decent car to have at Silverstone, and no one really saw that. When we were talking about it on the show last week, it looked like Mercedes were going to have the lead, and it was Ferrari going to be a little bit off, but Challengers and Red Bull way off. As it turned out, the three of them were reasonably close. So Vettel had a car to contend, and he just didn't do it. And the mistake that he made when he crashed into the back of Max Verstappen was something that I've not seen for a long time.
And if Vettel keeps making these mistakes, at what point is his job in danger?
So he has a contract until the end of next year.
So until then.
So I guess at the very least you can expect him to be there. The thing is, when they employed Sebastian Vettel, he replaced Fernando Alonso, who was supposed to be the saviour, you know, the guy who brought the title to Ferrari after Schumacher, and Alonso didn't deliver. So Vettel was supposed to do that when he came here, and clearly he hasn't done that. And if we're being honest, he hasn't really come that close to doing it. This year, he's been so far off the pace, to the point where his teammate, who's only in his second season, admittedly a great driver and a star of the future, is beating him. And it's just not something that I think Sebastian expected. I don't think it's something Ferrari expected. And they've got to be thinking right now, do we even keep him until the end of this season?
Is it that extreme?
It has to be. It's almost a year now, for the German Grand Prix. In fact, it is going to be a year, the German Grand Prix coming up, since that last race where he was really strong. And since then, he's made mistake after mistake after mistake. A year's worth of mistakes, admittedly over across the season, isn't great for a four-time world champion.
What's going on then? Is this psychological, where he makes one and then he makes another and then he's dwelling on those previous mistakes, so they just keep coming?
I imagine that is playing a part in it. I think everyone knows that you make one mistake and then you make another one, and that just puts pressure on you, whether that's in your day job or in elite sport. I don't think it's the difference. I think it's the same sort of thing. With Sebastian, I think there's so much pressure on him as a Ferrari driver to deliver. That's going to make it even worse.
And how big is that pressure? Is it that much bigger than for another major team like McLaren?
It's something that I don't think most of us will ever really understand. It's that big. You go there and you're carrying the hopes of a team who've got probably the biggest support in the world, but the hopes of a country in Italy. And they don't take defeat. They don't accept defeat. And I think if you go to Ferrari, you're expected to win.
But does it get to a point in any sport, not least F1, where if you've been a great side historically and things start slipping, eventually there's a consequential lowering of standards, right? You start adjusting what your targets are. If you look at Arsenal, their owners have released a statement today saying, listen, we can't compete for big trophies. Well, under 15 years ago, they were in a Champions League final. At what point for Ferrari do they have to go, well, we were great, but actually, you know what, we're just dropping off a bit and we're not at that level yet?
I think it would really help them if they did that. But then
rebuilt,
exactly. But they're just not prepared to do it. I think it's a pride element. I think they just feel like they have to be contending at the top. I think what you were just describing there, Johnny, is a really good way of how Ferrari could rebuild. They could just accept that maybe for 5 years, whatever it is, pick a time scale and say, look, we're not going to contend now for 5 years while we rebuild from the bottom up and get all the right people in the right place and get the best drivers and just nail this. And they're not prepared to do it because in the last 5 years they've been there or thereabouts, and it's not like they've dropped to the bottom like a McLaren did or Williams are right now. They're kind of just, they can see it and they can almost stretch to feel it, but they can't get there. And I think that that's the problem for Ferrari, is they just won't accept that what it really will take after given what's happened this year, it is going to be a complete rebuild. And that, well, I guess that's quite a hard thing to take for a company,
and that's for the drivers up.
I think so. Yeah, I think with Sebastian, they made the right choice in bringing him there. He'd won four titles with Red Bull. He'd shown that he was capable of doing it. The problem is he just doesn't seem to be able to drive the car in the way that he needs to be really happy. And what I mean by that, without going into too much detail, is the fact that certain drivers like certain things about a car. They like a looser rear end, or they like a tighter front end. And the thing is, if the car that is their driving doesn't suit them, it's very hard to drive around that. And for Sebastian, he's not that kind of driver, clearly, who can adapt to a car that isn't to his suiting. And he spent years now at Ferrari where perhaps they've tried to go closer to what he would like, and it still hasn't worked out. and he's now coming under pressure from a teammate who clearly can drive around a car. And he's now finding that the stronger that Charles is, the harder it is for him to deliver. And I guess when you're under pressure, he's just not coping with it very well. He's got a contract. I keep telling this, he's got a contract in next year, but that doesn't mean that he's going to be here next year. Ferrari have form. They've got rid of drivers years before their contract. They paid Kimi Raikkonen not to drive for them 1 year.
Imagine that. Ferrari, if you're listening, you can pay me not to drive for you. That's not a problem, although I am quite good.
I'm not sure, Ferrari. I would listen to Johnny.
Well, I would, actually. If it's a case of me driving for them, it'd be money quite well spent if they paid me not to. Of course, you're saying there that really Vettel needs to step his game up. Hamilton has already done that. It was a fantastic race at Silverstone. But beyond that, there's fantastic news as well, because the future of British F1 at Silverstone has been secured for another 5 years. They've got a new deal until 2024. It's fantastic stuff. And for a time, it really didn't look like this was going to happen.
This negotiation has gone on for 2 years. It's quite incredible, really. When Chase Carey, boss of F1, was talking about it, he did admit that perhaps talks didn't really kickstart until a year ago. But whatever way you look at it, it's a long time to be talking about a new deal, especially for a race that is so integral to Formula One. And I say that because it hosted the first Formula One Grand Prix back in 1950. Silverstone has hosted the British Grand Prix every year since 1987. It's one of those races that you feel like you just can't get rid of. It's like a Monaco, or it's like a Monza in Italy, or it's like a Spa in Belgium. They're races that really make Formula One what it is. And so I guess to a certain extent, it was unlikely that they weren't going to renew the contract. The fact is, they have done 5 years. I think it's really good for Formula One. I think it's really good for Silverstone. I think it's really good for British fans.
It's really good for Lewis Hamilton.
Oh, it's great. If the way that he's going, I mean, it's almost like a guarantee. Can you imagine if you're a driver, or say you're a football player and you know you're going to go to a particular stadium and win? I mean, what a feeling that would be.
Anyone going to Arsenal. It's a great feeling.
Just as well, I'm not an Arsenal fan, I suppose. With Lewis, he's delighted because he gets his home support. If you look in the grandstands, there was 355,000, I think, that turned up at Silverstone over the course of 3 days. I mean, first, what other sporting event gets those kind of numbers? But second, you look at the grandstands, it's full of like white, silver, green, the colours of Lewis Hamilton. They are obsessed. You drive into the circuit before the practice session and they're lining the street, and if they see someone that they know, they just pour onto the street, swarm the car stops for 15-20 minutes while he signs autographs. It's like fandom that I don't think I've seen in any other sport. It's quite remarkable. So you can kind of see why they were quite keen to keep Silverstone on the calendar. On top of that, it's a great circuit, and we saw that on Sunday. It delivers a great qualifying, it delivers a great race. We had good weather, which was fortunate, but the heat actually aided an entertaining race. So I think all in all, it's great news for Formula One, it's great news for British fans, and as you said, it's great news for Lewis Hamilton.
We saw a great, great race at the weekend, but was there an added frustration there as an F1 fan precisely because it was so good? Because as Lewis Hamilton has complained, you were having to compete for viewers with the small matter of a Cricket World Cup final that featured England, and of course the Wimbledon final as a result. As a consequence of that, a peak of 2.5 million viewers watched the British Grand Prix, closer to 10 million watched Wimbledon. Frustrating, surely.
It's disappointing when you've got three massive sporting events that they're all on the same day. You could look at it one way where it's quite good in that you can watch the British Grand Prix, you can watch the tennis at the same time, you can double screen it, and then you can watch the cricket at the finale. I know there was a lot of fans at Silverstone who stayed and watched the cricket on the big screen. And I guess you get that kind of great day of sport, just like at the Olympics we had Super Saturday, and you know, there's that excitement. But I do think that because Britain is a great sport-loving country, and I think we do sporting events very well, and I feel like if we can do that, why would we put them all on the same weekend? And if we can kind of get together and talk about it and say, you know, we've got the Cricket World Cup final this weekend, so let's not put Silverstone in the Wimbledon final. I know logistically it's challenging.
But why is it that challenging? Just put one of them on a different weekend.
So I guess Wimbledon, to start with, are generally always within, I guess, a four-week period. I'm not entirely certain, but it's generally like the last couple of weeks in June, July. And for them, it's important for them to stay within that period, whether they move one weekend or another. So fine, let's just say that we leave them where they're going to be. For Silverstone, actually, it's not that hard to move. Although, having said that, with Brexit happening, on a very practical level, it's going to cause problems next year. So when that kicks off, moving the trucks that take...
If it kicks off.
I know. Well, technically, it's supposed to kick off in October, isn't it?
Well, that's if Boris Johnson gets his way. Dominic Grieve will save us, don't worry.
Okay, so let's talk as if Brexit
Let's assume
happen.
It does happen.
Very practically, Formula One transports itself around on trucks when it's in Europe. So it could just be that there's not enough time. If you move Silverstone a week earlier, so it's back-to-back with Austria, or a week later where it's back-to-back with Germany, it might not be feasible to get the trucks across the channel to get to the race. And we can't have a scenario where we get into a race weekend and the trucks are still on the other side of the channel when practice is about to start in a couple of hours. So I think for next year, it's a potential issue about moving it from the Wimbledon final weekend. But I think beyond that, I think it is possible to do that. And I imagine the stakeholders of all those three sports are quite keen to do that.
Even with those Brexit concerns, there's an argument there that the onus has to be on F1 to move F1. I mean, if we look at the viewing figures, millions of people watched it, but millions fewer than watched the cricket and millions fewer again than Wimbledon. If you're the smallest fish in the pond, you kind of have to react to the other two, don't you?
I think, and the figures you just mentioned, the fact that Formula One was quite a way off the Wimbledon final, and I think it's
7 million off.
And was it 30 odd million that watched the cricket? It was a number, you know, much, much bigger than that. I think that I do understand that the one that is at the bottom of the pile has to move. And I do think they're going to want to move, but where do you move them to? Because once you move them to another slot, that means you've got to move whatever race you're moving it into to a different slot. And the very fact that we're in here coming towards the end of the middle of the July, towards the end of July, and we still haven't got a calendar for next year shows you how difficult it is to put together a racing calendar. Even just if you look in the prism within motorsport, there are clashes where the Monaco Grand Prix clashes with the Indy 500, one of the massive events in the world, really, in motorsport. Le Mans used to clash at Formula 1 as well. So it's not just Formula 1 having to think about other motorsport events it's not going to clash with. It needs to think about other sporting events in tennis and, as we saw, in cricket as well. It's difficult. It really isn't as easy as it was. Otherwise, we'd be doing it. But I think that there is going to be thinking within the stakeholders within Formula One to try and find a way that they can move the British Grand Prix. At the very least, move the time, the start time, so that you're earlier in the morning or later in the afternoon, just to make sure that there's not a direct clash. Because on Sunday, the direct clash with Wimbledon, where they both start at the same time, I think is not a great thing for sport as a whole. Not for tennis, not for Formula One. So I think that was a bit daft. But I think it would be good if we can find a way to find a different way going forward.
Absolutely. Well, it was a great Grand Prix nonetheless, and it's easy for us to focus on Hamilton, but actually Verstappen and Leclerc provided a good chunk of the excitement. Coming up, we're going to be asking, are they the future of F1, and can they be yet another great rivalry? Don't go anywhere.
This is Love Sport.
It's the Motorsport Show here on Love Sport Radio. You're with me, Johnny Burrow, and of course, Lawrence Barreto of F1.com. And we're joined on the line by Lawrence Edmondson, F1 editor for ESPN. Good evening, Lawrence. Thanks for joining us. We're talking Verstappen and Leclerc. Just how compelling was that duel at Silverstone?
Hi, thanks for having me back. It was a great duel, wasn't it? I think that's the kind of racing that actually we've been missing for quite a long part of the season. And to see it between two drivers who, okay, they're not fighting for the championship, but, you know, they're up there. And we saw them fighting against each other in Austria for the victory. And then this battle, I think, was even better than that. You know, I mean, okay, it didn't have a Grand Prix at stake, but seeing those two guys in two competitive cars go wheel to wheel, we don't get that too often, unfortunately, in Formula 1, but when we do, it's something to behold.
I think what I liked about the battle in Silverstone was that Charles just kind of seemed to have learned from what happened in Austria. And I wouldn't call it revenge, but I feel like he wanted to kind of put his mark maybe put something down on the ground to say to Max that he's not always going to have it his own way. And as you were saying, Lawrence, that I agree that, you know, they weren't fighting for the victory, but I still think it was a great battle to watch. And I think it's quite exciting that, given how young these guys are, we might be watching these two battling out for the next 10 to 15 years.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think that's what makes it so exciting, isn't it? But the other thing about these two is that they're the same age. They went through karting together. Their careers kind of split a bit later on in the junior categories, but now they're back together. But they actually have history, which is great. You know, I mean, they really weren't good mates in go-kart. And now Leclerc claims that, you know, they've kind of patched things up and, like, you know, they realise that they're both professional racing drivers and they leave it on the track. But there is a little bit of a backstory there as well, which is the kind of stuff we love in Formula One. And, you know, we had a similar thing between Hamilton and Rosberg when they were both at Mercedes. And this could develop into something quite similar. So, yeah, fantastic. And I completely agree with you about Leclerc learning the lesson. There was a moment at Club Corner where he almost did the reverse of what Verstappen did to him at Austria. And you could tell he was, you know, putting Verstappen out there right wide off the track, knowing that, well, the stewards didn't have a go at him, Verstappen, for doing it in Austria, so they can't have a go at him for doing it in Silverstone. So more of that would be fantastic. And I think we will see lots of that as the two careers of the drivers progress.
Lawrence, with that relationship when they were in karting together, why didn't they get on? What is that backstory?
It basically comes down to incidents on track. If you search YouTube, you'll find a brilliant video where the two of them, very young, very fresh-faced, are talking to a media company after a kart race. And in that kart race, unfortunately, I haven't been able to find the footage of it itself, but in that kart race, Leclerc knocked Verstappen off, and Leclerc went on to win the race, and Verstappen ended up further down the order. And I think ever since that, things have been a bit frosty. And, I mean, that's the thing as well. You've got to remember, these are actual kids doing go-karts, so... you know, they kind of have their rivalries. They have, you know, it's like when you're at school, you have kids you don't like, kids you do like. And that very much grows up in that way. So there's plenty there. I think we'll learn more about that backstory as things develop as well. You know, there's always some good stories to come out. So I'm sure a couple of interviews in with those two drivers will hear some good stories about what it was like back in the go-kart.
What I love about that video and that race is that they both reacted very differently. Obviously, Max went out and was furious, and you could see how angry he was when he was talking to the reporter, whereas Charles tried to play it down, was the calmer of the two. And I think that's quite an intriguing dynamic between the two that I think continues into Formula One, where we saw last year when Max had his incident with Esteban Ocon, he was the one who was quite aggressive, went over to Esteban and pushed him. And, you know, it was the same sort of thing that we saw in that video in the karting, where he was quite aggressive, whereas Charles, I think, always tries to play things down. He's much calmer. He doesn't want confrontation. And I think that's one of the interesting dynamics that we'll see evolve over time, because I feel like in Formula One, it's going to mean a lot more. And it'll be interesting to see whether Charles will be able to keep his counsel going forward. But I think... at least now, and at least at Silverstone, what I thought was quite good is that I wasn't expecting Red Bull to have been as close as they were to Ferrari and to Mercedes. And I think that's quite exciting, if at least for this season, if those two can kind of stay as close as they've been, we might see more of this going forward. I guess I'm interested, Lawrence, to see what you think as we look into the races coming up, whether you think Max or Charles will see more of this firstly, and whether you think there'll be who you think will come out on top.
Yeah, I think we will see a lot of this. And actually, I mean, the interesting thing is, if you remove Mercedes from the equation, I know we can't really do that because they're just a massive Formula One team, but if you do, the battle for third place in the Drivers' Championship is really exciting. Max leads it. I think he's 13 points ahead of Sebastian Vettel and 16 points ahead of Charles Leclerc. So they're incredibly competitive, the Red Bull in Max's hands and the Ferrari in both Kodak's hands. So I think we're going to see these guys appear on track quite a lot at the upcoming races. Red Bull have made a bit of a breakthrough since Austria, the new front wing, kind of getting that car into the correct window, getting the tyres into the correct window, most importantly. They still have a power disadvantage to Ferrari, which means that they seem to struggle in qualifying. They can't quite turn up the engine to the level that Ferrari and Mercedes can. But in the race, that car is competitive, and it might not always be able to challenge Mercedes, but I think in the race we'll often see it challenge Ferrari. And you can guarantee that Max will put it as high up the grid as he possibly can. At the very least, that's usually around fifth. At the most, it can be in between the Ferraris and further fourth. And then you're going to get the same kind of thing. You'll get more of the same racing. And Germany is actually a pretty good track for racing, some good overtaking opportunities. So I think we could see it as soon as 2 weeks' time.
I think it's exciting. And I think when you talk about Formula One you tend to, and big rivals, you tend to talk about Ayrton Senna and Alan Prost and I guess Schumacher and Alonso to an extent as well. Do you think that the Max Schall rivalry can kind of go to those kind of heights?
Absolutely. Yeah. They're the same age. And as you pointed out earlier, that they've got this kind of these very different personalities. And that always kind of creates conflict. I mean, with Senna and Prost, a lot of that, I think, came from their time together as teammates at McLaren. I can't see in the near future Verstappen joining Leclerc at Ferrari, despite the questions over Vettel's future. But I can't quite see Verstappen making that move. I think, if anywhere, the only place he would move forward is Mercedes if the place came up. But I do think that, you know, even in different cars, if they can both be in competitive cars at the front of the grid, which is what we're promised for 2021, if that can become a reality, I don't think it'll matter that they're not in the same team. I think they'll still have fireworks, they'll still bang wheels on track. And for someone like Max, you know, he's such a divisive character, even among the other drivers. You know, he's someone who will go there, who will race you as hard as absolutely possible. And if you don't like it, then, you know, as far as he's concerned, it's your problem. And that kind of attitude will always get someone's back up. And I think with Leclerc, he's going to find himself in that position quite a few times over his career, as long as they're still racing together.
As with all sporting rivalries, though, however well matched the two men or the two teams are, someone eventually has to edge it. Of these two guys, who do you think we're going to look back on and say he won that one?
I think it will be Verstappen. I've got a lot of respect for Leclerc. I think he'll be a very good driver going in the future. I think he's definitely got the potential to be a world champion in the right car. But Max has something that little bit more special. And at the moment, he's got about, I think it's 3 years experience on Leclerc in Formula One. It's always so hard to remember quite how long Max has been there, but they're the same age. But, you know, Max has been knocking around for a while now. So I think he's got that head start. And I think in terms of raw talent and in terms of pure determination and a really gritty racing driver, I don't think there's anyone who's quite a match for Verstappen at the moment. Lewis, I think, has other qualities which make him probably a better driver overall. But I think Max has got all that potential locked up in him. And I think as his career progresses, as long as he puts himself in the right position at the right time, he's going to win multiple championships.
I think that's key, isn't it? Where Max goes next, I guess, and whether he positions himself in the right place so that he can challenge for those world championships. Because I would agree with you, Lawrence, that I think of the two, he's the one who's in a position to win the more championships. Having said that, I do think that he's got some failings, perhaps, in that his approach and his temper, I guess. And I think there are things where maybe it might not work out for him and he might not end up making the right decisions, particularly with his dad, Jos, who plays quite a big part in the way that he approaches Formula One. And I wonder whether Charles, with a more level head, and now he's in at Ferrari, whether he might have the more opportunities. Because at the end of the day, in Formula One, it often isn't about whether you're the best driver in the field. It's more about whether you've got the right package to make the most of it. And we've seen drivers who, Fernando Alonso, for example, who is considered as one of the greatest drivers in Formula One, and he's only got, I say only, but he's only got 2 world championships. And I think that it just depends on whether you make the right decisions as much as whether you write off track as you do when you're on track. So it'll be interesting to see how that all pans out. Looking ahead to the next few races, Lawrence, I just wondered what you thought about what you think we might expect. You said Germany's good overtaking track and Hungary is a different track in itself. Do you think we're going to have a few good races like we had at Silverstone and Austria coming up?
I certainly hope so. And I think we should do. All the kind of things that went wrong in France several weeks ago now shouldn't happen at the two tracks coming up, as far as I'm concerned. The other thing which could play a real factor is the weather. If we get a real heat wave running across Central Europe through Hockenheim and the Hungaroring, then that could actually create issues for Mercedes. We saw in Austria when the temperatures were up above about 32 degrees, they started to struggle. So if it's really hot, if we get temperatures up to about 35, 36, which is possible in both of those locations, then we could see Mercedes kind of peg back a bit and then everybody else catch up. My only concern for the Hungaroring is that it's not going to be a circuit that suits Ferrari. They've still got problems with front end grip. You need plenty of it around there. It's a bit like Monaco without the walls. So I think that that could be another track where they struggle. However, that will give an opportunity for Red Bull to excel. So if I was going to put money on who's going to win those next two races, I'd still say Mercedes at both, but a bit of hot weather could really mix things up.
Wonderful stuff, Lawrence. Lovely to speak to you as ever. Thank you for your time. Lawrence Edmondson, the F1 editor for ESPN. One thing I want to touch on with you, Lawrence, is when we're talking about Verstappen and Leclerc, it's always framed in this backstory of the other great F1 rivalries between two great drivers. What are the few greatest as far as you're concerned?
I think Ayrton Senna, Alain Prost is probably the greatest rivalry in Formula 1 history. I think that what you had there is two characters who are so different, both on track and off track. And I think that that meant that they clashed a lot, both on track and off track. And I think that what we haven't had so much of that since those guys is a rivalry that's gone on for that kind of period of time. We've had Schumacher and Alonso, but that was all too short. We had Schumacher and Hakkinen, that was all too short. Even Lewis Hamilton and Nico Rosberg, again, all too short. You could look at it one way and say it's good that things have been mixing up, new drivers have come through, new opportunities had. But I think since the era of Senna and Prost, and then you had your Mansells and your Piquets, I feel like Formula One hasn't had that kind of excitement, that kind of those characters in the same way. And I think it is disappointing. Having said all that, if you look down the grid now, you've got great characters coming through. Clearly, Carlos Sainz and Lando Norris are very exciting drivers on track, but are having a lot of fun off it. Daniel Ricciardo is a great driver who likes to have a laugh. And I think that if we can get Formula One to a state where lots of drivers can compete for podiums and races and wins, I think you're going to start finding more rivalries are starting to form, and I think that's exciting for Formula One as a whole.
Lots to look forward to in the sport, and lots to look forward to on the show right here on Love Sport Radio, because coming up, it's time for our favourite feature with Lawrence Barreto, Inside the Motorhome.
This is Love Sport.
It's the Motorsport Show here on Love Sport Radio, and it's time for my favourite part of the show, Inside the Motorhome, so named because my glorious co-host Lawrence Barreto is such an experienced and well-known face on the F1 circuit that he's met the vast majority, it has to be said, of these famous names we talk about week in, week out, not in the context of them being behind a steering wheel, but just for a chat. We've talked Sainz, we've talked Hamilton. This week, it's time to talk Nigel Mansell, who, of course, is the second most successful British F1 driver of all time, behind only Lewis. He's the seventh most successful F1 driver, full stop. He's had success not just in F1, it has to be said, in the context of motorsport. This is a guy who also did seriously good things in kart, the first person to ever win the kart title in his debut season. And Lawrence, as you do, just knows him. First name terms, not a problem. I'm a big deal.
In this segment of the show, Johnny, we've tended to do current drivers, so I thought it'd be quite good to do a driver that perhaps we don't see so much off these days.
Well, he's 65, give him a break.
He's getting on a bit, but he's still keeping busy, still plays plenty of golf.
Does that count as being busy? My granddad always says that. I'm very busy. I'm playing golf. You're not busy. You're walking around a field.
That's busy, isn't it? You're out and about doing something.
I suppose.
So the moment that I want to talk about is when I interviewed Nigel 2 years ago now at the Autosport International Show. It's a trade show down at the NEC in Birmingham. They've got all sorts of motorsport championships come down, demonstrate it there. And I just got some time with him for a feature. And so I'm very lucky in that I get some time, more than 5-10 minutes, a quick chat, just to chat to these guys, and that gives them a chance to maybe relax into it a little bit, think a bit more about what they want to talk about. And this particular interview was about him and his racing career and what he thought about Formula One and the state of Formula One. But before we even started, he said to me, do you like magic? So
at that point, I would shout stranger and start running.
So if it was anyone other than Nigel Mansell, that's probably the right thing to do, Johnny. But I obviously knew who he was, and I obviously knew that he likes new magic. There was a story that I'd heard that when he used to drive for Williams, and Frank Williams, his wife, had cancer, and he would go around and to keep the kids entertained, he would do magic for them.
Oh, what a bloke.
Which is a really nice thing to do, isn't it?
Yeah, very nice.
And so I'd heard that he could do magic, but I hadn't actually seen it for myself. So obviously I said, yes, Nigel, let's see some magic. And he proceeded for the next 5 or 10 minutes to pull out a series of card tricks.
Rabbit out the helmet.
No rabbits. Fire. There was fire.
Fire?
Involved. Yeah.
So you just pull a lighter out and go, look, the wonders of modern technology. Magic.
No, it was more terrifying than that, because it was kind of like a little puff, a little flame popped up, a little
sorry,
bit of smoke.
Sorry. A little flame popped up out of where? His
well,
hand, the
well,
table?
I don't know, it's magic. So he had like...
Lord above. Was it in midair? Did he throw a fireball at you?
No, so there was cards, and he kind of threw something up into the air, and it turned into like a little fire bit of explosion.
Sounds like Nigel's the real deal.
Well, I don't know. It's probably a safety hazard, to be fair. But it was properly good. It wasn't any like rubbish card trick or anything. So I was dead impressed. Anyway, he wanted to do this for the next 10, 15 minutes. I only had like half a minute.
He had a full set prepared, presumably.
Well, I guess he just rolls this out whenever he's hanging out with people and needs to entertain. Or...
Yeah, he's had enough of talking about F1. Watch this.
But the beauty is we hadn't even started talking about Formula 1. We started the conversation with magic. So anyway, I said, this is great, Nigel, but like we need to crack on. Anyway, so... You ask him one question. First question, first answer he gives goes on for 5 minutes. Just talks and talks and talks. Gets lost along the way. Remembers this, that, and the other about.
A few pit stops.
Too many pit stops. Too many tyre changes. And we get to the end of it. I was like, Nigel, that's great, but now I'm running out of time, and this is what I wanted to talk about.
What for context? Yeah. What did you want to talk about, and what was the story he told you?
So what I wanted to talk about was at this point it'd been about 15 years, I think it had been since he won the title. So I wanted to talk about like what it means to him to be a world champion now. Does it make his life any different? That kind of thing. But also what he thinks about modern day Formula One, because it's very different to what it was like when he was racing. But he was kind of more excited about just telling me funny stories of what life was like when he was a Formula One driver, how he used to play pranks on his teammate Nelson Piquet and vice versa, how he used to have arguments with Sir Frank, his boss. Good mannered arguments, but like entertaining things.
Were they arguments like, no, Nigel, you can't do another magic trick, get back in the car?
he didn't talk about magic, no, but he was... I think he just wanted to have a lot of fun when he was a
racing
driver.
The engine's on fire. Stop it.
Get out. Just get out now. And I think that's what was quite... what I really like about Nigel is that he just wasn't... He wasn't there to just drive. He was there to have a bit of fun at the same time. And clearly now he's having a lot of fun with magic, not racing drivers. But we eventually got onto what he thought about Formula One. And what amazed me about it was that he just knew what had been going on. He'd been watching races since he finished racing. He'd been keeping in touch with people he used to know who he worked with in Formula One, had really good opinions about what he thought should happen. And that always surprises me, because I always think that when you retire from something, if you don't like work as a pundit or anything like that, you might want to cut yourself off from it and go do something different. But there's one thing about Nigel, he just can't. He can't let go in a nice way. Like Formula One is a clear part of him. Like it means so much to him. And he can, it's like your granddad when he wants to tell you a story. He's just happy to regale you with tales and about tale
out.
After tale. No, you wouldn't though. You'd entertain the fact that he wanted to tell you. Sure.
No, you're
Johnny.
Right. I would.
And I think that's what surprised me the most about him, was that he was just up for talking, and we ended up talking for just over an hour, which meant he was late for his next thing. But he was it doesn't matter almost, because he wanted to get across what he wanted to get across, and also he wanted to give me what I needed for my feature that I wanted to write. And he was aware that he'd wasted 15 minutes at the start doing magic.
Well, that is a lovely story. Nigel Mansell, CBE, of course, is obviously a lovely bloke, but every Inside the Motorhome we've ever done, you've delivered me, and I'm very grateful, but you've delivered me with heartwarming stories about what nice blokes these F1 drivers are. Now, there are two options here, Lawrence. One is that everyone who's ever stepped into an F1 car is a delightful human being. The other is that you're playing your cards quite carefully and that this is actually a sport with egos and, dare I say it, some not particularly nice people, and you don't want to spill the beans.
I think everyone has bad days.
Oh, yeah.
And they all
so
just...
So which F1 drivers tend to have bad days in
well,
your experience?
They've all had good days when I was there.
Always. Yeah. Okay, funny that. Okay, inside the very friendly motorhome with Lawrence Barreto, another wonderful addition there, finding out that Nigel Mansell, former Formula One world champion, can make fire appear at will. Quite something. Coming up, we've suddenly had a competition appear at will, because is it a three-way battle for this championship? Back in just a moment.
This is Love Sport.
It's the Motorsport Show here on Love Sport Radio. And don't worry, Lawrence Barreto, off air, my lips are sealed. He spilt the beans. And it turns out not every F1 driver is delightful. Possibly next time out, we'll have to let you know who isn't perhaps as perfect as they appear. But just a couple, there was a look of real fear in your eyes then. You thought I was going to drop you in it. Just a couple of weeks ago, we were talking about this season as a write-off. McLaren definitely going to win. Now, Mercedes. Hamilton, of course, still way out in front, looking very, very comfortable. But are things now a bit closer than they might have been? We're joined on the line by Michael Laminato, who's F1 journalist and strategy report host. Good evening, Michael. Thank you for joining us. Could we see an upset?
An upset in the championship. I don't want to break your heart, but I think that might be a little bit ambitious. I'm happy to say that we could have some exciting racing, though.
Okay, well, I'll tell you, it's not quite heartbreak. We'll call it jilted, but not at the altar.
Yeah, I think that's pretty much the case. Silverstone was a good sign, I suppose. We should all be very happy, of course, that the racing was good. That goes without saying. But I think what we should be looking forward to is that Red Bull Racing and Ferrari can catch up to Mercedes. I even have to prevent myself from saying catch in its entirety, but certainly catch up to the point where we can get, when the conditions are right, a really interesting race between them. And I think at this point, it seems kind of clear that Ferrari and Red Bull Racing are pretty similar on pace. Again, might be circuit dependent, but they're pretty close, which means the racing between them is good when Sebastian Vettel's not involved, of course. And that's good news for us.
I think that the interesting thing with Ferrari and Red Bull, and we saw at Silverstone, is they were just closer when no one really expected them to be closer. And I hope that if this European heat wave continues into the next couple of races, that might help. Because at the end of the day, you've got to look at what might benefit them. And what doesn't benefit Mercedes is hot races and with their cooling problems.
Yeah, global warming can't really come soon enough for Formula One, can it? It's the one positive we can extract from this situation. It was so hot, if we go back to Austria at the Red Bull Ring, to have such an effect on Mercedes. And I suppose we can kind of hope that that might happen in certainly Hungary. In Budapest, it tends to be hot. And this weekend, the race is even, I think, a weekend later at the start of August. So maybe there's something to look forward to there. But I think what we really have to hope is that, first of all, as the heat situation did demonstrate, the Mercedes is not completely infallible, which means they can be caught up. And we know that certainly Red Bull Racing's most recent history is that they can develop very quickly. And even, to give credit, of course, to Ferrari, last year their car was excellent for most of the season. So there's no reason that once they kind of address the problems with the chassis that they know they've got this with this year's car, that they can't then catch up. Because we are dealing with teams that are all very competent. It just so happens that Mercedes found themselves with this head start at this point of the year that's sort of turned the first half of the year into making a very obvious conclusion for this championship.
I think massive respect to Mercedes, because the job that they've done to be able to have gone and won 9 out of the first 10 races is extraordinary, really. And I think that we should celebrate the fact that they've been able to do that. But the fan in me is saying, I really wish, as you were suggesting, that, you know, Red Bull do develop in the way that they have done, and Ferrari do make the most of a car that, you know, in pre-season testing looked like it could contend for the world title. I think what will be interesting going forward is, even if they don't mount that world championship fight in the end, because Mercedes have built too much of a lead, it's just if they can keep improving to an extent that they can create these kind of races that we had in Austria and Silverstone. Because after France, we were all talking about, well, many people were saying Formula One's in crisis, is that right? And then Austria happened and F1's been saved, and Silverstone's happened and saved again. And I kind of just feel like Formula One in the last couple of races has shown what Formula One can be like if you get everything right, and if you have all the teams competing at the right level and you're on a circuit that fosters good racing and you get good weather conditions, it just shows what we can expect if everything goes right.
Yeah, and it's absolutely right. There's so much, and I think it's sometimes a little bit underappreciated in Formula One, in motorsport in general, that there is so much complexity in motorsport. And I'm not just talking about the cars or even the rules, and I know we like to complain that the rules are complex, but into making a good race, it does involve stuff like the circuit profile. And Silverstone played such a big part in developing what turned out to be a really good race, simply from the track layout and even the surface of the track. Things as mundane as asphalt can play a really big part in creating a really good race. And then, of course, you've got the difference in the performance of the cars and the drivers that you can't really liken it to another kind of sport. And in a perhaps interesting analogy, considering the weekend we had with Wimbledon, you know, Novak Djokovic and Roger Federer have been among them, and only a couple of others, been winning pretty much everything in men's tennis, right? But people will still be glued to their televisions to watch these uber successful tennis players play. But then you come to motorsport and you've got Lewis Hamilton, who's equally successful, and people find it a bit of a turnoff when he wins everything. Even if we did get a rivalry, let's say with Valtteri Bottas, it'd still be somehow a little bit of a turnoff because it's not as competitive. So I think it is important, as you sort of started that question by saying, that we should appreciate how good a job they are also doing to, in conditions that are so hard for everyone else to master, do such a good job and win 9 out of 10 so far.
It's extraordinary stuff, and it's sounding like, even though you're not willing to concede that there could be an upset, because it's almost impossible, we will have some excitement coming up. Michael, lovely to speak to you. Thanks for your time. Michael Laminato, the F1 journalist and strategy report host. Lawrence, could one of those exciting races be the German Grand Prix, which is coming up? Silverstone, of course, is quite conducive to overtaking. Are we going to see the same kind of thing in Germany?
I hope so, and it would be quite good to get a third good race on the bounce. As Lawrence, the other Lawrence, was saying earlier in the show, there's lots of Lawrences. Hockenheim is a circuit that does deliver good racing, and I think that we're coming there at a point on the back of two really strong races when Ferrari and Red Bull have been stronger. I think it's quite hopeful that we could get another good race there. If I think it's important that the weather plays its part, because that really has had a factor in a way that we really haven't seen it in the last few years. It's Mercedes' home race, and I think they'll be desperate to impress there. And I guess when we were looking at the data in the lead up to the race, and we've got a team that crunches the numbers and kind of bases what's happened in the season so far, and then takes into account the factors of the circuit that we're going to, Mercedes should be the ones to beat again there, which I guess is unsurprising. Goodness, they've been the ones to beat at most races this year. But I think Ferrari and Red Bull should be closer, and I think that's all we need, really. We just need them all to be close enough so that if there are a couple of factors, whether it's the weather, whether it's a safety car thrown out, whether it's just the track-specific characteristics, I think that's all we need, is them close enough that we can mix things up a little bit.
And are you expecting that Hamilton and Bottas battle to come to the fore again, or is Lewis going to retake control?
I think, given what happened at Silverstone, I think we can be hopeful that Bottas is going to be in there and he's going to give it a good go. I don't think he's been flattened yet, and I think if people at the start of this season might have thought that Lewis would have had the upper hand on Bottas by now, and he hasn't really, and that's credit to Bottas that he's been able to hold on to this point. I think it's still clear that Lewis is the better driver and Lewis is still the more likely winner, but I think what is exciting and encouraging is that Bottas is fighting. He's showing that he's in there for the fight, and I think at a circuit like in Germany, in Hockenheim, I think we might actually see an extension of that battle.
It's very exciting to look forward to. If Bottas does win, is Lewis going to take that well?
No, he's going to take it badly, like very, very badly.
How badly are we talking? What kind of reaction could we expect?
I don't think we're going to see him punching fists through the walls like we've seen some drivers do when things don't go well. But I think you're going to see a very disappointed, disheartened driver who won't pretend to be happy when he's talking to the media afterwards. He's going to show that he's disappointed at what's happened. And a Lewis that's disappointed is about, if you're one of his rivals, is about the best thing you can hope for, because you can then hope to try and assert some pressure. It's very hard to do that and I'm not sure if that's going to be the case, but he'll give it a good go, I'm sure.
And if you're a manager and Lewis Hamilton gets disappointed, just give him some strawberry laces and he'll be fine. It's sounding like he won't be disappointed at all. His side, of course, still very much favourites for the German Grand Prix. Join us next week on the Motorsport Show, where we'll be telling you all about it. See you then.
Thanks for downloading this podcast from Love Sport Radio. For more, go to lovesportradio.com for all the latest podcasts, news, and views. Or for more, follow us at Love Sport Radio on Twitter.